Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Jones. Bowden.
He's got it.
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match.
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket with me, Simon Hughes.
And me, Simon Mann.
We're going to switch from Red Bull cricket and the test series, which we were covering very enthusiastically over the last couple of months, to white ball just for a couple of weeks, because it very much is white ball season, certainly abroad, if not at home, for two reasons. I think three reasons, actually, we're switching to white ball. One, because it's the 100 draft tonight, so lots of players on tenterhooks to see which 100 team picks them up. Secondly, Friday is the start of the IPL. I think it's the 16th season of the IPL. Amazing sequence of events that has precipitated over the years. And thirdly, we've got a special guest today, a man who is very skilled in white ball cricket in particular, David Visa, originally from South Africa, but has been playing for Namibia. In fact, a dual nationality, multi-franchise, super versatile cricketer, the modern image of a cricketer. David, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. And one of the reasons we got you on today is because you've now got your own podcast, which has been coming out over the last couple of weeks, a series called Hitman for Hire, A Year in the Life of a Franchise Cricketer. And as we've worked out, Simon and I, you've played for at least 16 different franchises. So it's a well-named podcast, isn't it?
Yeah. Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it. I've played for a couple teams. That's no secret. I think you're actually being kind to me with 16. I think it's pretty a little bit higher than that. You know, there's not much space left on my click info profile to actually list the teams anymore. But you know, for me, it's just, you know, fortunate that I've gotten so many opportunities over the years to do what I've done, and you know, to be able to play in all these franchise tournaments and, you know, rub shoulders with the best players in the world. It's something that I've been very fortunate over the years.
Actually, you say not much space on your Crickinfo profile. Presumably, although you have a fairly empty backdrop behind you, I wouldn't have thought you've got much space in your bedroom for all your kit. I mean, what happens to all the different shirts and, you know, sets of uniforms and stuff that you've got to wear? Do you keep them? Do you auction them off? What happens?
Yeah, I'm quite sentimental, so I still keep everything. My garage doesn't have much space left for the cars. They tend to stand outside with all of the kit and clothes. And I've gotten better over the years. I've only keep most of the playing clothes now. Helmets is the nice one for me. I keep all the helmets. I've got this idea that one day I'll have this nice bar in my house where I can just hang up all the helmets and, you know, keep that memorabilia going. But, you know, when I started it, I didn't think I'd be having so many helmets hanging up. So I might have to come up with a different idea. But they are stacking quite high now, and I might have to make a plan at some stage.
You might have to accessorise those with motorcycles then as well. Start a sort of motorcycle shop with lots of different coloured helmets. It worked brilliant. And just tell us, you know, a little bit about your podcast. So, as I said, it's called Hitman for Hire. So what's the essence of it? I mean, I suppose it was based on last year where you played, I think, probably more franchises than you've ever played for.
Yeah, so the idea came about with myself and my co-host Simon Keir. We basically just wanted to collect a bit of an insight to what goes on, you know, behind the scenes of franchise cricket. You know, everybody sees all the glitz and glamour. They see the big price tags. They, you know, watch the games and see the big clouds. But they don't actually know what goes on behind the scenes. You know, the time spent away from the family, the sacrifices that you have to make, you know, the difficulties of not actually having a home base, you know, just being, like we said, there mercenary for different teams. You know, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that we wanted to highlight, and just, you know, hopefully people can listen to it and, you know, they get to know what actually goes into being a franchise cricketer a bit better.
Do you have fun? You know, obviously, it's changed your life. I mean, you came to franchise cricket relatively late, I think, didn't you? Sort of early 30s. So, you know, before that, you'd had a fairly, I suppose, traditional career in first-class cricket in South Africa and started to play a bit of South Africa cricket, didn't you? You started to play for the country in T20. How has franchise cricket and this opportunity to be a sort of gun for hire, if you like, hitman for hire, you call it, how has that changed your life?
It's changed my life massively, and it all started actually when I signed a call pack for Sussex. That's when this whole journey actually started. You know, for me, I never really saw myself as playing all of these franchise tournaments. I played one or two IPLs, but, you know, it was only really when I started playing for Sussex that a lot more opportunities came along. I mean, the South African summer where we play over here, it actually clashes with quite a few of the franchise tournaments, so you're quite limited to where you can play. But once you play in the UK summer, it actually opens up quite a bit. And, you know, I went through a patch where I wasn't actually getting picked up for so many leagues, and then fortunately I got one or two deals and did well there, and then it just snowballed from there. But, you know, like I said, I think I was only about 32, 33 when I actually started becoming more of a franchise cricketer. Before that, I was just, you know, the run-of-the-mill, playing first class, playing, you know, all the different formats, and just trying to make a living at the end of the day, I suppose.
Do you know how many teams you play for, David? We tried to work it out from your cricket info profile. Do you know how many teams you play for during your career or not?
I'll be lying if I have to give you the correct amount. There's so many smaller teams also that there's been. You know, I've played one game in a tournament over here, and it's got to be, I reckon, maybe in the 20s at least. I know I'm catching up with Imran Tahir. He's up there with all the teams that he's played for. But I've definitely, you know, had my fair share of teams over the years.
What's the most perhaps obscure league that you've played in?
Have you ever played in the Nepal one? Everest?
Yeah, I actually never played that one. I never played the Everest League. I've never played in the once off Afghanistan league that there was.
T10?
T10, I've played a couple T10s, the Abu Dhabi T10. I've done all of the leagues basically, except for the Super Smash and the Big Bash. Those are the two that have eluded me. But I've never had to go into the. I know there's a lot of these US tournaments that have been taking place, also the minor leagues and all of that. I've never had to go to that side yet. Canada. I'd love to play Canada. I think it seems like a good tournament and a good place to go to. So Canada is the one that's actually on my bucket list for this year. Hopefully.
Well, I'm actually I'm involved potentially with the coverage of that, and I just heard the other day that's early August, I think. Sort of, so that might clash with the 100 actually.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know, that's the thing at this stage is that after the World Cup there's the July-August window where there's like four tournaments that are getting taken place at the same time. So you know, it's so difficult to balance it nowadays and, you know, to go over here for a full tournament, but then you miss the start of this one, and it's really becoming a juggling act. Yeah. It's interesting how franchises are actually going to handle it now, whether they're going to prioritize guys who are just fully available, or if they're almost going to split and say, okay, we'll have these players for the first half, these players for the second half. It's going to be an interesting, after the World Cup, to see if the guys are going to want to play or not, if they want to take time off. It's going to be interesting to see how the guys do it.
It's amazing, isn't it, how it's changed? Because, I go back, 20 years, and it was just play for one county and then go abroad and play for someone else. And that was it, your two teams. And now you're juggling, as you said, your whole calendar. I mean, do you almost have a sort of wall chart up there, kind of, figuring out which bits you could probably access and which bits are out of your range, and how do you manage the year?
Yeah, so you do actually, we do it. We sit down at the start of the year and, you almost plan these tournaments are taking place at these times. These are the tournaments that you've been retained for. So a tournament for me, the Pakistan Super League, I've been retained for the last 6 years there. So I've known that February, March window, I'm in Pakistan. Then you see, okay, I was with Sussex for the Blast a couple of times, so that window's there. Then the July, August window, there's a possibility of this. And then there's the CPL at this time. And then you just kind of plan your season okay, I want to play over here, but then I need to take a month off, so I'll miss out on this one, and then I'll go back for that one again. And it's just, just trying to balance it as much as you possibly can. It's always nice when you actually get retained, then you know for a fact that you're going to be there. Or if you get signed before the auction, then you know that, okay, at least I'm secure in that my space for that team at that specific tournament. The tough part comes in when you have to start going to auctions and drafts where you're not quite sure whether you're going to go or not. So you can't plan too far ahead. I mean, my wife, she's been wanting to go on holiday for a long time now, but every single time we try and do something, there's okay, just hang on, there's an auction coming up, we first need to see. And so it is tough with that side. So the best way to do it is if you can almost just pre-sign for every single tournament, then at least you know at the start of the year, okay, this is my calendar for the season.
So you've got the 100 draft coming up, I guess. Are you someone who listens to kind of watches it, follows the stream, or do you wait for your agent to tell you what's happened?
A little bit of both. I'm not somebody who will sit live and watch it, but every 10, 15 minutes, I'll go on social media, just check the little updates and see what's going on. I won't be doing it this time. I'm actually playing a game tonight. So, that'll be at the back of my mind, and we'll see what happens. But I've enjoyed my last 2 years in the 100. It's a tournament that I think it's a fantastic concept, and it's a great tournament to be involved in. So, hopefully something comes along for me this evening.
In which tournament, David, have you had the most fun? I mean, you play for all these teams and all these countries. What one tournament, one team that sort of sticks in your mind? You think, that we all came together. That really worked. I really enjoyed this 4-6 weeks or whatever it was.
Yeah, it's actually a tough one because every single team and every single tournament's got a different feel to it. The one that's always special for me is the Pakistan Super League for the Lahore Qalandars. They're the team that actually gave me the opportunity at the start. They got me in as a replacement when I wasn't really playing in any other leagues. And, since 2019, I've been with them. And it's a team that we've kept the same core over the last 6 years. So we've been the same players there. We started off bottom of the table and then we came back and, won back-to-back championships. So as a team going, that's a special connection we've got going over there. And then, on the flip side of it, whenever you go into these tournaments, you always look at kind of who your teammates are, who the other overseas players are, and then you gauge on, how much fun you're going to have. The one that I really enjoyed last year was the Major League. I thought that was an awesome tournament. It also affected...
So that's the one in the US, yeah?
Yeah, that was in the US. I'd never played in the US before, so to go to Houston and Dallas, go check out over there, that was quite cool. I had a good bunch of guys played for Mumbai, New York, so I had Tim David with me, Devil Plevers, Trent Bolt, a good bunch of guys who I've known for a while, and we just had fun on the field, but, off the field, we also, we went to go watch a baseball game, and we went to go play golf. We there was just a lot to do over there. So, then that side of the things, it's difficult to enjoy yourself too much when you in, say, Pakistan, when you can't really leave the hotel. So where the cricket is enjoyable, the off-field doesn't quite match up with it. And then you get tournaments like in Dubai or in the US, where you know you've got a lot to do off field also, which just adds to the tournament also.
How easy is it to get together as a team at the start of a tournament when you are, well, you're not thrown together because there's a lot of analytics that goes into it these days, but how easy is it to sort of get together as a team? You could perhaps explain how much time you get together as a team actually in various tournaments before you start playing. And you sort of, you know, you've sort of got a click with everyone. How does that work?
It is tough, and it depends on tournament for tournament and player for player. I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, you used to go in a week before the time, you know, have two or three training sessions, get used to the conditions, you know, have one or two team meals before the time just to gel and click with everybody, and then you go on playing. But, you know, with the landscape as it is nowadays, I've flown into a tournament, land at 7 o'clock in the morning, and 6 o'clock that evening, I've played a game. You know, because there's so many overlappings that they go on nowadays, it's sometimes difficult to gauge that. But I always like to go in about 2 or 3 days for a tournament, so you can still, you know, have one or two training sessions, get to know the guys. Well, I say get to know the guys. I mean, there's so many tournaments nowadays, and it tends to be the same guys who play in these tournaments. So, you know, most of the time you know most of the people there, and you actually get on with them before. And it's actually relatively easy. I find it easy to click as a team because, you know, everyone just got a common interest there. They want to go, they want to do well, they want to showcase their skills. And you know, ultimately for me as a team, if you win the tournament, that means as a player, you've done your job. And, you know, there's a good chance that you'll be back again next year. So, you know, everybody just wants to go there and win the tournament and, you know, just contribute towards the team.
I suppose there is that element, isn't there, that you, people say, well, you know, how can you bond as a team and produce a team that wants to win, you know, when you're just, you know, it's here one day, there the next. But I suppose there's a financial imperative, isn't it? You have to do well because that's your next meal ticket, isn't it? You do well in one tournament so you can play in another.
100%. I've said the whole time, every single tournament you play in is an audition for the next one, and you are only one bad tournament away from never getting a job again. You know, you go and have one shocking tournament, guys are going to start questioning you. There's always younger guys that are coming up trying to you know, put their stamp on things. So, you know, it's actually, you know, it's highly pressured out there because you know that you have one bad showing, and especially in a team where only four overseas guys can play, but there's often 7, 8 guys that are there. You have one or two bad performances, you out, next guy comes in, and you know, that could possibly be the end of your career.
And what about, you talked about getting together, you know most of the players. I mean, do you ever have to be introduced to some of the players, or do you actually do literally know them all these days?
One or two of the local players you tend to get introduced to. But in terms of the overseas guys and most of the franchise guys, I've been playing for a couple of years now. So, you know, like I say, you tend to play with or against the same guys the whole time. So there's generally not too many people out there that I don't know or have met before.
And what about in terms of rivalries? I mean, I presume there might be games where you're going hammer and tongs at somebody, and then the next week you might actually be playing with them. I mean, presumably that's happened quite a lot, is it?
Yeah, there is. And, you know, in these tournaments, there's always, not necessarily like players that have rivalries, but there's teams and franchises that have big rivalries. So I look in, you know, the PSL, you've got Lahore and Karachi. They're the two big cities. They two, you know, big teams that clash the whole time. And, you know, you can be playing for Lahore the one year, the next year you play for Karachi, and now you have to have this bravado that, oh, this is the team that we don't like. And it's all actually, you know, it's taught us that you can actually go and be quite intense on the field. I mean, there's always limits and boundaries, but you can go play hard on the field, and then after the game, everybody's just mates again, and you can go and enjoy a beer and you know, just chat cricket and life with your opposition, because, you know, next tournament you guys actually might be on the same side again.
Actually, I think that's a really good point about the influence that franchise cricket's had, because, again, you know, going back to my era, we were all mates off the field, and there was a lot of camaraderie at the end of the game. You know, you go to the bar, the hotel, the pavilion, you know, the members or whatever, and get a beer with players that you've just been hammer and tongs on the field against. I felt that declined, that kind of socialising of the game sort of got lost a bit when people became a bit more serious, and the training got more kind of regimented, and people turned up in tracksuits and went home straight after the game. You know, sort of probably, I don't know, 15 years ago. and there was a bit of a disconnect between rival teams, and possibly as a result, I don't know whether that sort of stirred up a bit of animosity or whatever, but perhaps the franchise thing, when you watch in England v Australia now, or England v India or whoever, you know, there's obviously that hugely competitive edge on the field, but you see them all sort of chatting before play or after play. And I feel like franchise cricket has sort of brought international players and, you know, players from different countries back together almost in a way. What do you think?
No, 100%. I remember when I was playing for Sussex, you know, we always used to, on day two of a four-day game, everybody goes to the players' pavilion and, you know, you have a beer with opposition. And, you know, that started to dwindle out also. So, you know, I think that did get lost a little bit in the game, which is a pity, because I thought that was, you know, an integral part of the game. You got to know people, you got to learn from other players the whole time. And, you know, to lose that for the younger generation was, you know, was sad for me. But, you know, like I say now, it's difficult when you stuck in the same hotel with a guy for 6 to 8 weeks not to get on with him. You know, you can have any preconceived ideas about playing against this guy, but when you're staying in the same hotel and being the same team for 6 to 8 weeks, you tend to just get on with people and, you know, you get to know them more as a human and not just as a player. And, you know, then you tend to just build on those relationships. So when you see them again, even though they're in opposition, you guys almost have that connect more, not just a cricket connect, but more human connect also. And I think that's been good for the game. Guys have pulled together more. You'll see, like I said, even when you're playing in a test match, it's a hard fought match, but then after the game, you'll see pictures of both teams in the change rooms enjoying each other's company. You know, I remember when I played for South Africa back in the day, we used to have joint fines meetings after the game with the opposition. After a hard fought series, you still go and have a joint fines meeting and just enjoy each other's company. So, you know, I find that's been good for the game, just to actually pull guys together and, you know, just to get that culture going again.
There must be a player, though, David, you thought, oh, no, not him again, not him on my team for the next 4 to 6 weeks.
No, to be honest with you, I think I'm actually could be one of those guys where they're like, oh, no, not that guy again. I mean, he's such a grumpy old man or whatever. But I'm quite
nothing wrong with grumpy old man.
Yeah, I think it comes with age. So, you know, I'm like a fine wine now. So it's I'm aging a bit, but I'm still there. But I just find that if you're just nice and a decent human being and, you know, just a good person, it's kind of difficult not to like you. And the guys nowadays, because of the whole franchise circuit, they know that if they're going to, you know, be difficult, then teams just aren't going to pick them up anymore, because, you know, why do you want to deal with a guy who's difficult for 6 weeks when you can deal with someone who's got a similar skill that's just a good, decent guy? So, you know, in terms of the circuit, there's not really too many guys where you're like, oh, no, not him again. There could be one or two guys when you're actually playing against them, you're like, oh, no, not this guy again. He's going to take us down or tear us apart. But, you know, in terms of off-field, guys are fairly chilled nowadays.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So we're talking to David Visa, the multi-franchise cricketer, who, of course, has got this podcast series out called Hitman for Hire. And one of the things, David, you reveal in your podcast series, and maybe you'll be able to reveal it now, is which player was picked up in his Bentley while the rest of the team waited for the bus.
That was an interesting moment for me, because it just showed like the value of guys in the IPL and how the IPL has changed people's lives. I don't want to mention too many names or anything there. He was one of the more senior players in our team, local player also. But and when we got to his hometown, obviously he went home, didn't stay in the hotel. He went home to see his family, and you know, obviously not getting on the team bus, getting picked up in his Bentley with his driver. That was difficult to miss. So it was quite one of those funny moments. You're like, yeah, okay, this is what the IPL is about. This is the glitz and glamour and everything about the IPL. And everybody else is sitting there on a team bus, and there he goes off in his Bentley home. So
yeah. This was in India?
Yeah, it was during the IPL, yes.
And are you going to tell us which city?
It was, I think, when we got to Delhi. It was when we got to Delhi, yeah. So there we go. We could figure it out. It's one of the KKR players when we got to who was based in Delhi.
Okay. Interesting. I know a great story about the original IPL year, 2008, when Shane Warne, of course, the great Shane Warne, was captain of the Rajasthan Royals, and one of the young players in that team was Ravindra Jadeja, who then was only 18 and hadn't really been, you know, discovered properly, but the Royals gave him a chance. And one of the things that they found about him was not only was he incredibly talented, but he was also incredibly ill-disciplined, and he was always late for the bus. So after the first time that he was late for the bus, Warnie said, right, we're not waiting for him. And they just took the bus to the ground, and Jadeja had to hitch a lift and got there, you know, at some point later. But he didn't learn his lesson even when it got to the final. And on the final at Navi Mumbai, again, he was late for the bus, and Warnie said, right, we're not waiting for him. And they left. And Jadeja had to get a lift with two Royals fans from the hotel. But, you know, it's interesting because now Jadeja is someone who, you know, he's a world-class, amazing cricketer. And
I think he'd be able to step out of the hotel, to be honest. So,
well, yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, imagine how many people would offer him a lift if he didn't get on the team bus. So I suppose it's up to him. But is it very different playing in the IPL to any other tournament?
Yes, it is, in the sense of everything is just next level. Everything is heightened. You know, you from the moment you get there, you can just feel the buzz about the IPL in India. I actually asked some of the local players there, you know, is it like this all year round? Is it, you know, when you guys are playing your local T20 competition, you know, is there this buzz? Is there so many fans? And they're like, no, they're just driving to the ground and it's just normal life. So, you know, once a year for those 6 to 8 weeks that the IPL takes place, everything is just on a, you know, on a buzz, on a knife edge. Everything is just, you know, heightened. You can see the hotels, they prepare a whole year round just for this. The stadiums, everything's looked after specifically to showcase the IPL. And it's just, you know, next level everything, and that just comes from the Indian fans and the support that they've got over there. And then obviously, you know, like I said, 16 years of IPL, it's become quite a institution in itself now, and you know, everybody knows that, you know, best players in the world are playing in the IPL. So if you want to see these guys, you know, go hang out outside the hotel or go watch a stadium, and you know, go to the stadium there, you might bump into somebody. And yeah, it's a unique experience that you can't actually explain to anybody until they're involved with it.
How intense is it? You know, it seems to be, you know, a lot of matches crammed into a relatively short space of time. India's a huge country. I mean, are you on the go all the time, basically over the, you know, 6-8 weeks of the tournament, or you know, is there any chance for downtime, or does it feel really intense?
No, it is full on. And I know last year when I was there again, it was the first time since COVID that they played in every single city, home and away. So it was genuinely 8 weeks of full on. You would play, travel the next day, have one training session, and then play, travel. There was only once where we played back-to-back home games. The rest of the time, it was up and down, up and down. I don't know if that was just how our schedule worked out, that we didn't have that much time at home. I think the most time that we spent in one hotel was obviously our base in KKR. And I think it was 7 days that we were in the hotel before we had to leave again. So it is full on. It's heavy travel days. You know, you go there, you get to the airport, and it's just chaos at the airport, and you stand in line there, and sometimes you feel like a zoo animal that, you know, you're sitting there and everybody's just looking at you and taking photos the whole time. And, you know, it's a privilege to be there, and you know, it's an honor for the fans to be out there and, you know, to want to take photos and everything, but it does get intense after a while. You know, when you've been on the road for 6 weeks and it's towards the end of the tournament, and now you've got to do another travel day, and, you know, it's a long day. It gets a bit much after a while, but it is the IPL is full on in terms of traveling and training. You got minimal days off.
Actually, I traveled with the Royals for a couple of weeks in 2018, 2019. And that there was 1 week where we had four matches. They had four matches in three different cities. So it went Jaipur, Mumbai, Chennai, and back to Jaipur. And it involved something like six flights in that time, because you had to do a sort of, you know, intermediate. Oh, no, and Hyderabad. Hyderabad's in that world. So it went Jaipur, Mumbai, Hyderabad, Chennai, back to Jaipur. I mean, and it was exhausting just following it, never mind being the player. What about your daily routine in a tournament? You know, assuming that you have an 8 o'clock start or 7 o'clock start, evening start, how do you structure your day?
Yes, so there is something called IPL time or franchise time, I find it. You know, I'm the type of person, when I'm at home with, you know, having two young kids at home, you tend to be up at 5:30, 6 in the morning. If you do that on tour, you're going to burn yourself out, because everything happens so much later on tour and in these franchise tournaments. You know, some games don't start until 8 p.m. So, you know, you kind of tend to find that your days are a bit skewed. So you only end up waking up at about 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, because you only get to bed at 2, 3 after a game. So, you know, your mornings and your afternoons sometimes get a little bit muddled. You don't really remember days of the week or what the date is or anything. You just know in 2 days' time I'm playing and leaving. And it gets a bit tough. But, you know, it's usually wake up around about 10, 11, have breakfast, and then just kill time until you'll have a team meeting or a bowlers meeting or something, and then head off to the field at the specific time. Yeah, it's a lot of Netflix, a lot of downtime, and, you know, just keeping yourself busy.
And also, you reveal in your podcast what is a franchise cricketer's new form of relaxation, you know, instead of golf. So what is that?
Yeah, there's been a massive, massive increase in paddle. Everybody's playing paddle nowadays. They used to be, like I said, you know, golf used to be the number one go-to, you know, get out, and every single off day you would go play golf. But it seems like paddle's taking over the world now. You know, it's easier for, I would assume it's easier for guys who aren't really that good at it to actually play. It's quite a good workout, and it doesn't take as long as golf. So, you know, I remember during the T10 last year, there was 26 guys on a golf group, and they would book like 6-4 balls every single day, and then you'll just drop in and out whether you wanted to play or not. But now during the SA20, it was just paddle, full on paddle every single day, every single opportunity. Guys would play paddle and got quite competitive. You would have your partner, and they would be your partner for the tournament, and then, you know, you would take on different guys, and it gets quite competitive. As sportsmen, you know, it doesn't matter what you do, you still just want to win the whole time.
You better just explain, David, for those who don't know, what paddle is.
We're not talking paddle board here, by the way.
Yeah. No, so paddle is, I would say it's a combination of squash, tennis, maybe a little bit of ping pong if you put the table in there. It's just basically a small tennis court with a squash effect, like a glass around it, so you can hit the ball against the glass to come back. It can bounce against the glass, but you still have to get it over the net. Yeah, it's quite a unique sport, and it's quite fun. To be fair, it is quite fun, and like I said, you don't have to be that athletic or that good at it to actually go and play it.
It's a slightly different ball, isn't it? As well, it's a slightly bouncier ball, right?
Yes, so it is actually I actually Googled this to find out. It is like 10% smaller than a tennis ball, and its pressure is only, I think, 90% of a tennis ball. So it's not as bouncy, not as hard, but it's got the same effect to it. And obviously your racket's a little bit smaller, and you know, so you can whack it and it doesn't fly that far. But it's a great sport, and it's really taken off, and you know, it seems to be all over the place nowadays.
I often have the impression that cricketers actually prefer to be playing golf. So are we getting to the stage where they're going to actually prefer to be playing paddle rather than cricket?
I think the intensity of the game might actually get higher than what you do on the field. I've seen some of the guys who have quite intense rivalries on the paddle court, and you get quite obsessed with it. You know, like anything new, you start something, you know, you're trying to get better and better at it, and guys have gotten quite obsessed to the point where during the SA20 this year, the you know, physios actually had to tell guys, you know, hang on a little bit. Maybe, you know, the day before a game isn't the best time to be playing paddle. You know, you could be picking up a little bit of injuries, a little bit of niggles over here. So guys are getting quite full on with it at this stage.
David, I'd like to ask you a couple of more T20 focused questions. One of them is how important is your head coach, and what makes a good head coach in a T20 franchise?
Yeah, I think it's to be a head coach of a franchise is quite unique, because I always see it as you're more just a man manager than an actual coach. You know, the tournament's only 4 to 5 weeks long, so you know, you're only going to spend a limited amount of time with a player. And, you know, technically, how much are you actually going to teach a guy? And also, if a guy's playing in this franchise tournament, he's pretty good at what he does. So, you know, you don't really have to teach him that much. So I always see the best coaches just as more facilitators, you know, man managers, knowing, you know, analyzing a player and seeing what that specific player needs to get the best out of him, whether it is more training, less training, you know, a bit of time away from the field, just trying to gauge what makes that guy tick, and then, you know, facilitating that as much as you possibly can. In terms of coaching, I mean, like I said, if you can add 1 or 2% to a guy's game, that's awesome. But, you know, most of the time it's just more, how do you get the best out of your players?
And what about the role of analytics in T20? I mean, are you not constantly being updated with analysis and stats that are relevant to you? Is that a sort of huge aspect of T20, or is it kept to a minimum once it's been sort of synthesized, if you like, that the coaching staff have found, say, the three most important messages that they want to get over to a player?
Yeah, so quite often, again, that changes as you go from team to team. I think what seems to work, and what most of the teams tend to do now, is that the analyst will send all the details to you personally, and then what you do with it is up to you.
What would that look like, David?
Yeah, so
send all the details.
It'll be a couple video clips of a batsman, how he's got an out in the last innings, where his boundary shots are, where his dot balls are, you know, what his strike rate would be against a change of pace compared to this and that. And then just like his wagon wheel, to where he hits most of the time. And then it's up to the player. I know some players don't like to analyze too much. They like to go and feel, and they like to just, you know, react to what's in front of them. Other players believe in it. You know, I feel like there is a place to it, because if you can just get that extra 1 or 2% out of the game, then, you know, why not go for it? But it has become, you know, gone are the days now where you sit for an hour and a half analyzing a bowling attack or, you know, batting unit that you're going to be facing. It's just more personal nowadays, and it'll be, yeah, guys, yes, the package of the team we're playing against. If you want to see anything else, or if you want to have any other questions, just let me know, get in touch, and then we can, you know, take it from there.
I know you've got a match today, so we better bring this to a close, I think. A couple of quick questions, though. You've obviously played in all these franchise tournaments in the last 7, 8 to 10 years. How has your game changed? Or do you think your game has improved from all this experience around the world, or because you've played in largely T20, so you're only bowling 4 overs, you're only getting the chance to face, you know, 20 balls or whatever sometimes. Has that affected your game in some way compared to what you were, you know, when you were in your 20s, say?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me specifically, of course, I've, for the last 3 or 4 years just be focusing on the T20 skill. You know, it's a completely different skill to playing four-day cricket. And, you know, I've always found that, you know, playing so many years of four-day cricket gave me a good base. But, you know, now when it comes to T20s, it's very specific in the way you go about things. And for me, even more, you know, batting where I bat and you know, being, you know, more the finisher or in the team, there's a specific way about going about things. And, you know, I've only learned that by playing in more tournaments and getting more opportunities to be in those situations. You know, I've always found that it's a bit of a strange one because batting just seems to evolve every single year. There's new shots, new guys doing what they do. But bowling has become a little bit stagnant because, you know, there's only so much you can do. And, you know, after that, it's just down to execution all the time. So I feel like, you know, the batting has actually overtaken the game a little bit more. And because of that, you kind of can't stand still as a player. You need to keep, you know, evolving. You need to keep playing. And I find that, you know, just by being more specific about what you do things, me going into the net, it's pointless me facing a new ball because if I face a new ball, that means we're in pretty much trouble. So, you know, if I go train, it's just more about, okay, face maybe 10 balls and then just do death hitting and being really specific with what you're doing, who you're going to be facing as opposition, and, you know, just try and just simulate the game as much as you possibly can.
I share your concern about bowlers. And I'll take you back just briefly to the 18th century. And there was a character who played in sort of 18th century cricket for the MCC and for England 11 called Frederick Beauchamp. And he was a canny bowler who wore a flashy watch on his wrist. And he tried to make the watch glint as he let go of the ball to deceive the batsman. Now, I noticed you got pretty heavy tattoos on your right arm, your bowling arm. Maybe you could do a little bit of decoration on the tattoo. Hold your tattoo up. Show us your arm. Show us your sleeve.
It's quite
pretty impressive.
On,
what actually is it? It's just a design, random design?
No, it's actually not. It started off as the, obviously, play for South Africa. It's called, you know, it's the Protea. So I've got a couple of Protea flowers there with my ODI and T20 number. Then it just progressed to a pocket watch, which is a family heirloom, got to a compass. And then when I had kids, it just got to, you know, the kids' names and all the specific dates and everything down there. It just kind of evolved as it went along. So,
you should have every franchise tattooed on some bit of it. You cover your
whole
body, wouldn't it?
Don't have enough space in my body for that.
Anyway, you know, maybe a couple of bits of flashy, like glinting stuff on your tattoo could deceive the batsman.
Batsmen are so full of nonsense. I played a game where a batsman was complaining that the cameraman behind the bowler, his watch was shining, like you say, and he had to go and take his watch off. So it's a batter's game. It doesn't matter, you know, what you do. The batters always get their way at the end of the day.
Well, so your advice, I suppose, to a young cricketer would be a batsman, is it? I mean, what would your advice to a young player be now?
I would say, just be very specific with what you do. Don't, like, for a long time, I find myself to be like a jack of all trades and master of none type of thing. You know, from the bowling side, you think you need to have 7 different variations and, you know, do so many different things, but you actually don't do one thing well. I think, you know, as a youngster nowadays, I would say find that one thing that you're the best at and just stick with that and make that your primary skill. Make sure you become the best as you can be with that specific skill, and then just top up smaller things, you know, on top of that, basically.
Good advice. So you're playing tonight for who?
For the Titans. It's the franchise-based in Pretoria. It's a team that I actually started playing for back in the day. I played 6 or 7 seasons for them before I signed Colpack. It's a bit of a homecoming for me. I've playing a bit of games here before the World Cup just to stay with it and stay busy.
And I guess then it will stop you from listening into the 100 draft tonight, but you're hoping to get another sign up there, another gig, presumably?
Yeah, definitely. I spent the last 2 years in the Northern Superchargers. And, you know, it's a tournament I've enjoyed. And, you know, the UK is a great place. It's a place I've spent a lot of time in, and I enjoy going there. The family enjoys coming out also. You know, and the 100 is a concept that, you know, it's unique to that one tournament. And, you know, it's nice to have all the different T20 tournaments, but then you've got the 100 that's very specific, and then, you know, you go back to, you know, so it's not the monotony of just T20s the whole time. It's nice to have that little bit of a break in format. And, you know, I find the 100 is quite unique, and you know, you have to play it very differently to the way you actually play a T20 tournament, which makes it quite interesting.
Send Freddie a message then tonight. Send him a text saying, pick me, because, of course, Andrew Flintoff is going to be the new head coach of the Northern Superchargers. So exciting times, I'm sure. Listen, good luck with your match tonight and the future part of your career. And also good luck with the podcast, Hitman for Hire, which is out now on the Sports Social Podcast Network. Many thanks for your time, and fascinating to hear.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys. And, yeah, we'll chat soon. Have a good one.
Fascinating to listen to David Easter there, Simon, actually. And you're involved with the IPL with the BBC, aren't you?
Yeah, the BBC are going to be covering the IPL again. We've got 45 matches over the next 2 months. I think we're 74 in all to cram in before the T20 World Cup. And it's relentless, isn't it? It really is for the players. You know, switching from one tournament to the next. David there was talking about going to the T20 World Cup and fine-tuning with the Titans, because he's going to be playing with Namibia, because he's sort of switched from South Africa to Namibia. He's got a Namibian father, so he's able to qualify and play for Namibia now. It makes you wonder, actually, we should have probably asked him how long he's going to keep doing it. I suppose when there's money in them their hills, you keep on going, don't you, really? You're getting picked up all the time by these franchises. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that IPL Friday. RCB, presumably the return of Coley and the return of MS Dhoni, still going. El Cid is still going. They strapped him on the horse and pushed him out again.
Well, of course, he doesn't have to do much, does he, really? I mean, he doesn't run. He hardly runs. He just hit sixes off the last couple of overs and then stands as wicketkeeper. I mean, actually, last year he did one amazing stumping where he rushed across to sort of short square leg and flicked the ball back and ran the guy out. So he's still pretty mobile. And I guess, you know, as Jimmy Anderson has also proved, that if you don't play too much, you can kind of keep your body in cotton wool and then come out and perform again. So, well, you know, it'll be exciting to see. For those who like that sort of cricket, of course, it's now only a couple of weeks until the county season starts. And I noticed quite a lot of counties already playing warm-up matches abroad. I think Middlesex are at Hampshire next week at the newly named Utilita Bowl, now formerly the Aegeus Bowl. So lots happening in English cricket, which of course we'll cover as well. Actually, tomorrow night I'm going to the Cowdery Lecture at MCC at Lords, which this year features Tail Enders, another podcast, of course, with, I presume, Greg James, Felix White and Jimmy Anderson appearing on stage. So I'll report back from that, and we'll be back at the weekend for more cricketing conversation. Thanks for your time. Thanks for listening. See you soon.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.